Note 7. Now when Manwë, gazing in sorrow from height and Yggdrasil, saw all these things done, he sent for Lórien and for Orome, thinking them less stubborn of heart than the others, and when they were come, he spoke earnestly with them. Yet he would not that the labour of the gods be undone, for he thought it not altogether ill, but he prevailed on those twain to do his bidding in certain matters. And in this manner did they so, for Lórien wove a way of delicate magic, and it fared by winding roads most secret from the eastern lands and all the great wildernesses of the world, even to the walls of Kor, and it ran past the cottage of the children of the earth, note 8, and thence down the lane of whispering elms until it reached the sea. But the gloomy seas and all the straits it bridged with slender bridges resting on the air, and greyly gleaming, as it were, of silken mists lit by a thin moon, or of pearly vapours. Yet beside the Valar and the elves have no man's eyes beheld it, save in sweet slumbers in their heart's youth. Longest of all ways is it, and few are there ever reach its end. So many lands and marvellous places of allurement and of loveliness doth it pass ere it comes to Elfinesse. Yet smooth is it to the feet, and none tire ever who fare that way. Such, then, said Vaire, was and still is the manner of Olore Male, the path of dreams. But of far other sort was the work of Orome, who, hearing the words of Manwë, went speedily to Vana, his wife, and begged of her a tress of her long golden hair. Now the hair of Vana the Fair had become more long and radiant still since the days of her offering to Aule, and she gave to Orome of its golden threads. Then did he dip these in the radiance of Cululin, but Vana wove them cunningly to a leash immeasurable, and therewith Orome strode swiftly to the gatherings of Manwë on the mountain. Then calling loudly that Manwë and Varda and all their folk come forth, he held before their eyes his thong of gold, and they knew not his purpose. But Orome bid them cast their eyes on that hill that is called Calorme, standing hugely in the lands most distant from Valinor, and is held most lofty, save Taniquetil, yet seemeth therefrom a dim thing, fading afar off. Even as they watched, Orome stepped back, and putting all his cunning and his strength thereto, he made a mighty cast, and that golden cord sped in a curve through the sky, until its noose caught Calorme's topmost pinnacle. Then, by the magic of its making and the cunning of Orome's hand, it stayed a bright golden curve, and neither drooped nor sagged. But Orome fastened its hither end to a pillar in Manwë's courts, and turning to those who gazed upon him, said, "Who then listeth to wander in the great lands? Let him follow me." And thereat he set foot upon the thong, and sped like the wind out over the gulf even to Calorme, while all upon Taniquetil were silent in amaze. Now did Orome loosen the thong from Calorme's peak, and run the swiftly back, ravelling it as he came, until once more he stood before Manwë. Then said he, "Lo, O Sulimo, lord of the airs, a way I have devised, whereby any of the Valar of good heart may fare whithersoever they list in the great land. For whither they wish I will cast my slender bridge, and its hither end wilt thou securely guard." And of this work of Orome's came that mighty wonder of the heavens, that all men look upon and marvel at, and some fear much, pondering what it may portend. Yet doth that bridge wear a different aspect at different times, and in various regions of the earth, and seldom is it visible to men and elves. Now, because it glistens most marvellously in the slanting rays of the sun, and when the rains of heaven moisten it, it shines most magically therein, and the gold light breaks upon its dripping cords to many hues of purple, green and red, so do men most often name it the rainbow, but many other names have they fashioned also, and the fairies call it Ilwaran, the bridge of heaven. Now living men may not tread the swaying threads of Ilwaran, and few of the Eldar have the heart, yet other paths for elves and men to fare to Valinor are there none since those days, save one alone, and it is very dark. Yet is it very short? The shortest and swiftest of all roads, and very rough, for Mandos made it, and Fui set it in its place. Kalvanda is it called, the road of death, and it leads only to the halls of Mandas and Pui. Twofold is it, and one way tread the elves, and the other the souls of men, and never do they mingle. Note 9. Thus, said Vairi, was the hiding of Valinor achieved, and the Valar let slip the chance of a glory more splendid and enduring even than that great glory which was theirs and still is. Nonetheless are there still very mighty tidings of those days to tell, of which perchance I may now recount to you a few, and one I will name the Haven of the Sun. Behold, now are the hearts of all set at rest by the truce, note 10, of Manwë and the Valar, and while the gods feast in Valmar and the heaven is full of the ungoverned glory of the ships of light, the elves go back at last to rebuild the happiness of Kor, and there they seek to forget all the sorrows and all the labours that had come among them since the release of Melko. Now does Kor become the fairest and most delicate lovely of all the realms of Valinor, for in the courtyard of Inwë those two elfin trees shone still tenderly, and they were shoots of the glorious trees now dead, given by the gods to Inwë in the first days of that town's building. Others, too, had been given to Nolemë, but these were uprooted and were gone no one knew whither, and more had there never been. Note 11. Yet even though the elves trusted the Valar to shield the land and weave protection about them, and though the days of sorrow faring into the past grew dim, still could they not yet utterly shake away the memory of their unhappiness, nor did they ever so until after the magic way of Lórien was complete, and the children of the fathers of men, first were suffered to come there in sweet sleep. Then did a new joy burn very brightly in their hearts, but these things were not yet come to pass, and men were yet but new wakened on the earth. But Manwë and Ulmo, knowing their hour was come, held high councils for their protection. Many designs they made therein, and they were weighed down by the thought of Melko and the wandering of the gnomes, yet did the other folk of Valinor trouble themselves little with such matters yet. Nonetheless, Manwë ventured to speak once more to the Valar, albeit he uttered no word of men, and he reminded them that in their labours for the concealment of their land, they had let slip from thought the waywardness of the sun and moon. Now it was the fear of Manwë, lest the earth become unbearable by reason of the great light and heat of those bright things, and Yavanna's heart was in accord with him in that. But the most of the Valar and the elves saw good in his design, because in the lifting of the sun and moon to higher paths, they thought to set a final end to all their labours, removing those piercing beams more far, that all those hills and regions of their abode be not too bright illumined, and that none might ever again espy them afar off. Wherefore, said some, let us send now messengers to discover the fashion of the world in the uttermost east, beyond even the sight of Manwë from the mountain of the world. Then arose Orome, that I can tell you, for I have seen. In the east, beyond the tumbled lands, there is a silent beach and a dark and empty sea. And the gods marvelled at these tidings, yet never before had any save Orome listed to see or hear such things, not even Yavanna, the Earth Lady. Nought do I say of Ulmo Vailimo, Lord of Vai, for of a truth all such matters he knew from the beginning of the earth. Now therefore did that ancient one follow Orome, expounding to the Valar what was the secret nature of the earth, and he said, lo, there is but one ocean, and that is Vai, for those that Ose esteemeth as oceans are but seas, waters that lie in the hollows of the rock. But Vai runneth from the wall of things unto the wall of things, whithersoever you may fare. Now to the north is it so cold that even its pale waters are frozen to a depth beyond thought or sounding, and to the south is such utter darkness and deceit, by reason of Ungoliant, note 12, that none save I alone may find a way. In this vast water floateth the wide earth, upheld by the word of Ilúvatar, for naught else, or fish or bark, will swim therein, to whom I have not spoken the great word that Ilúvatar said to me, and bound them with the spell. But of the wide earth is even Valinor a part, and the substance of the earth is stone and metal, and the seas are pools in its hollows, and the islands, save some few that swim still unfettered, stand now like pinnacles from their weedy depths. Know then that somewhat nearer stands Valinor to the great wall of things wherein Ilúvatar hath enclosed us than doth that furthest eastern shore. And this do I know, for diving beneath the world often have I visited those unharbored beaches. For lo, O Valar, ye know not all wonders, and many secret things are there beneath the earth's dark keel, even where I have my mighty halls of Ulmonan, that ye have never dreamed on. But, said Manwe, true is that, O Ulmo Valimo, but what is it to our present purpose? And Ulmo answered, lo, I will take Aule the smith with me, and convey him safe and swift beneath the waters of Vi in my deep-sea car, even to the eastern shores, and there will he and I build havens for the ships, and from the east hereafter shall they arise, and give their fullest light and glory to men who need them, and to the unhappy Noldoli, following one the other over the sky, and coming home to Valinor. Here, when their hearts wax faint by reason of their journeyings, shall they rest awhile upon the outer seas, and Urwendi bathe in Fascalan, and Ilinsor drink of the quiet waters of the lake Irtinza, ere ever they return again. Now this speech had Manwe and Ulmo designed in collusion, and the Valar and Eldar hearkened for diverse reasons as before. Wherefore was Aule sped now with Ulmo, and they builded great havens in the east, beside the soundless sea. And the haven of the sun was wide and golden, but the haven of the moon was set within the same harbourage, and it was white, having gates of silver and of pearl, that shone faintly so soon as the sun sank from the heavens into Valinor. At that hour do those gates open of themselves before the issuing moon, but none of the Eldar have seen these things save Wole Kuvion, and he has told no tale. Now at first the Valar purposed to draw the sun and moon beneath the earth, hallowing them with Ulmo's spell, that Vi harm them not, each at its appointed time. Yet in the end they found that Sari, note 13, might not even so safely come beneath the world, for it was too frail and lissom, and much precious radiance was spilled in their attempts about the deepest waters, and escaped to linger as secret sparks in many an unknown ocean cavern. These have many elfin divers, and divers of the fays long time sought beyond the outmost east, even as is sung in the song of the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl. Note 14. Indeed, for a while, mishap fell even upon bright Urwendi, that she wandered the dark grots and endless passages of Ulmo's realm, until Fionwe found her and brought her back to Valinor. But the full tale is called the Tale of Corinomi, and may not here be told. Note 15. Thus came it that the gods dared a very great deed, the most mighty of all their works, for making a fleet of magic rafts and boats with Ulmo's aid, and otherwise had none of these endured to sail upon the waters of Vi, they drew to the wall of things, and there they made the door of night, Moritarnon, or Tarnhui, as the Eldar name it in their tongues. There it still stands, utterly black and huge against the deep blue walls. Its pillars are of the mightiest basalt, and its lintel likewise, but great dragons of black stone are carved thereon, and shadowy smoke pours slowly from their jaws. Gates it has, unbreakable, and none know how they were made or set, for the Eldar were not suffered to be in that dread building, and it is the last secret of the gods, and not the onset of the world will force that door, which opens to a mystic word alone. That word Urwendi only knows, and Manwe who spake it to her. For beyond the door of night is the outer dark, and he who passes therethrough may escape the world and death, and hear things not yet for the ears of earth-dwellers. And this may not be. In the east, however, was the work of the gods of other sort, for there was a great arch made, and 'tis said 'tis all of shining gold, and barred with silver gates. Yet few have beheld it, even of the gods, for the wealth of glowing vapours that are often swathed about it. Now the gates of Morn open also before Urwendi only, and the word she speaks is the same that she utters at the door of night, but it is reversed. So comes it that ever now, as the ship of the moon leaves his haven in the east and his gates of pearl, Ulmo draws the galleon of the sun before the door of night. Then speaks Urwendi the mystic word, and they open outward before her, and a gust of darkness sweeps in, but perishes before her blazing light. And the galleon of the sun goes out into the limitless dark, and coming behind the world, finds the east again. There doth Sari, filled with the lightness of the morning, ride through the gates, and Urwendi and her maidens make a sound of golden horns, and dawn is spilt upon the eyes of men. Note 16. Yet many a time and oft, a tiny star ship of Varda that has dipped into the outer seas, as often they will, is sucked through that door of night behind the sun, and some track her galleon through the starless vast back unto the eastern wall, and some are lost forever, and some glimmer beyond the door until the sun ship issues forth again. Note 17. Then do these leap back and rush up into the sky again, or flee across its spaces. And this is a very beautiful thing to see, the fountains of the stars. Behold, the moon dares not the utter loneliness of the outer dark by reason of his lesser light and majesty, and he journeys still beneath the world, and many are the chances of that way. Wherefore is it that he is often less timely than the sun, and is more fickle. Sometimes he comes not after Sari at all, and other times is late and maketh but a little voyage, or even dares the heavens, while Urwendi still is there. Then smile the gods wistfully and say, it is the mingling of the lights once more. Note 18. Long was this indeed the manner of the ship's guidance, and long was it after those days that the gods grew afraid once more for the sun and moon, because of certain tidings of those days, which perchance may after be told. And because of their fear, a new and strange thing befell. Now the manner of this mayhap I may tell before I make an end, and it is called the weaving of the days and months and of the years. For know that even as the great gods sat in conclave, pondering how they might fetter the lamps of heaven ever to their hand, and guide their goings, even as a charioteer doth guide his galloping horses, behold, three aged men stood before them and saluted Manwë. But Manwë asked them who they were, for well I know, quoth he, that ye are not of the glad folk that dwell in Valmar, or the gardens of the gods. And the Valar marvelled how they came unaided to their land. Now those men were of strange aspect, seeming aged beyond count, albeit of strength untamed. And one that stood at the left was exceeding small and short, and another amidmost of middle stature, and the third was long and tall. And the first had short hair and a small beard, and the others was neither long nor short, but the beard of the third swept the earth before his feet as he walked. Now after a while he that was short and small spake in answer to Manwë, and he said, brothers are we, and men of exceeding subtle craft. And the other answered, lo, Danuin, Ranuin, and Fanuin are we called, and I am Ranuin, and Danuin has spoken. Footnote. In the margin is written, Dogor, Monath, and Misere, old English words, meaning day, month, and year. End of footnote. Then said Fanuin, and we will offer thee our skill in your perplexity. Yet who we are, and whence we come, or whither we go, that we will tell to you, only if ye accept our rede, and after we have wrought as we desire. Then some of the gods said them nay, fearing a trick, even perhaps of Melko, and others would grant their request. And such was the counsel that in the end prevailed, because of the great perplexity of the time. Then did those three, Danuin, and Ranuin, and Fanuin, beg that a room might be set apart for them. And this was done in Aule's house. There did they spin and weave in secret, and after a space of twice 12 hours, Danuin came forth and spake to Manwë, saying, behold my handicraft. And none knew his intent, for his hands were empty. But when the ship of the sun returned, Then went Danwin to her stern, and laying his hand thereon, he bid Ulmo draw her, as was his wont, over the waters to the door of night. And when Ulmo was gone a little way from the further shore of Valinor, Danwin stepped back, and behold, Ulmo might not draw the sun ship further, not though he put forth all his strength. Then were Manwë and Ulmo and all that beheld afraid, but Danwin after released the sun and went from among them, and they might not find him. But after 20 nights and 8 came forth Ranwin, and he said also, Behold my handicraft! And yet no more could be seen in his outstretched hands than before in those of Danwin. Now Ranwin waited until Elinsor brought the Rose of Silpion unto Valinor, and then going he set his hands against a jag of glass upon that isle, and thereafter might no man stir Elinsor's bark far from Ranwin against his will. But again Ranwin spake no word, and went from among them. Then Rana was released, but Ranwin no man could find. Now the gods pondered long what this might portend, but naught more betid, until 13 times had Rana waxed and waned. Then came forth Fernwin, and he bid the gods detain Elinsor, that at Sari's coming both ships might stand in Valinor at once. But when this was done, he begged aid of the gods, for, said he, I have fashioned somewhat of great weight that I would fain show to you, yet cannot of my own strength hail it forth. And 7 of the stoutest from the halls of Tulkas went to the place of Fanuin's labouring, and could not see aught therein. But he bid them stoop, and them seemed they laid hands upon a mighty cable, and staggered beneath it as they laid it upon their shoulders, yet could they not see it. Then going unto Sari and to Rana in turn, Fanuin moved his hands, as though he were making fast a great rope to each of those vessels. But when all was done, he said to Manwë, Lo, O Sulimo, lord of the gods, the work is wrought, and the ships of light are set in the unbreakable fetters of time, which neither ye nor they may ever break, nor may they escape therefrom, albeit these fetters are invisible to all beings that Ilúvatar has made, for nonetheless are they the strongest of things. Then suddenly, behold, Danwin and Ranwin stood beside him, and Danwin, going to Manwë, placed in his hand a slender cord, but Manwë saw it not. Herewith, said Danwin, O Manwë Sulimo, canst thou govern the goings and comings of the sun, and never may she be brought beyond the guidance of your hand, and such is the virtue of this cord, that the goings and returnings of the sun shall be accounted the most timely and inevitable of all things on earth. Thereafter did Ranwin in like manner, and behold Manwë felt a stout rope within his palm invisible. Herewith, said Ranwin, shalt thou hold and steer the wayward moon as well as may be, and so great is the virtue of the thong of Ranwin, that even the fickle and untimely moon shall be a measure of time to elves and men. Lastly did Fanuin bid bear his mighty cable's end to Manwë, and Manwë touched it, and it was made fast to a great rock upon Tanikwatil, that is called, therefore, Gonlath. And Fanuin said, Now doth this mightiest cable hold both the moon and sun in tow, and herewith mayest thou coordinate their motions and interweave their fates, for the rope of Fanuin is the rope of years, and Urwendi issuing through the door of night shall wind it all tangled with the day cord's slender meshes round and about the earth until the great end come, and so shall all the world and the dwellers within it, both gods and elves and men, and all the creatures that go and the things that have roots thereon, be bound about in the bonds of time. Then were all the gods afraid, seeing what was come, and knowing that hereafter even they should in counted time be subject to slow eld, and their bright days to waning, until Ilúvatar at the great end calls them back. But Fanuin said, Nay, it is but the music of the Ainur, for behold, who are we, Danwin, Ranwin, and Fanuin, day and month and year, but the children of Arluin of time, who is the oldest of the Ainur, and is beyond and subject to Ilúvatar. And thence came we, and thither go we now. Then did those three vanish from Valinor, but of such is the framing of the moveless courses of the sun and moon, and the subjection of all things within the world to time and change. But as for the ships of light themselves, behold, O Gilfanon and all that hearken, I will end the tale of Lindo and Vire concerning the building of the sun and moon with that great foreboding that was spoken among the gods when first the door of night was opened. For 'tis said that ere the great end come, Melko shall in some wise contrive a quarrel between moon and sun, and Ilinthor shall seek to follow Orwendi through the gates, and when they are gone the gates of both east and west will be destroyed, and Orwendi and Ilinthor shall be lost. So shall it be that Fionwe Urion, son of Manwe, of love for Orwendi, shall in the end be Melko's bane, and shall destroy the world to destroy his foe, and so shall all things then be rolled away. Note 19. And thus ended Vire, and the great tale fell silent in the room. Notes. 1. They, original reading, the Solosimpi. 2. The rejected draft text of the tale to this point is remarkably brief, and reads as follows, following on from Ilios's remarks given in the tale of the Sun and Moon, side 7, note 20. That is easy told, said Lindo, for the murmurings that I have spoken of grew ever louder, and came to speech at that council which was now summoned to fix the courses of the sun and moon, and all the ancient grievance that had flamed before at Melko's instigation concerning the freedom of the elves, even that strife that ended in the exile of the Nololi, grew sore again. Yet were few now in pity of the gnomes, and such of the Eldar whom the new-lit world allured dared not for the power of Melko break from Valinor. Wherefore, in the end, the enemies of the gnomes, despite all that Ulmo might say or plead, and despite the clemency of Manwe, carried the counsels of the gods, and so came that which stories name the closing, changed from hiding of Valinor. And the gods went not at that time forth to fight Melko, and their greatest opportunity for glory and eternal honour was let slip, open brackets, even as the music of Ilúvatar had foreboded, and they little understood it, and who knows if the salvation of the world and the freeing of men and elves shall ever come from them again. Some there are who whisper that it is not so, and hope dwelleth only in a far land of men, but how so that may be, I do not know. Close brackets. The concluding passage is thus bracketed in the manuscript with a question mark against it. 3. The word looks like east. The word eastward was added to the text, and it may be that my father intended to change east to eastward edge, or something similar. 4. Here earth is clearly used, if strangely so, in the same way as is the world, to mean the great lands, as distinguished from the outer lands of the west. 5. The Teleri, i.e. the later Vanyar, had not in the old story departed from Kor. See The Theft of Melko, side 6. 6. Originally, Owen and then Onen, the name of Osse's wife, has already appeared in the final form, Uinen, The Coming of the Elves, side 5, The Tale of the Sun and Moon, side 7. But Oinen here is clear and clearly intended. 7. In the draft text, the account of the hiding of Valinor is very brief, and moves on quickly to the path of dreams. The webs of darkness laid on the eastward slopes of the mountains were not those sloughed in Valinor by Ungueliante, but are merely compared to the most clinging that ever Ungueliante wove. Helcaraxe and the Magic Isles are only mentioned in a marginal direction that they are to be included. 8. Earth is again used in the sense of the great lands, see note 4. The draft has here children of the world. 9. While there are no differences of any substance in the account of the Olore Male in the two texts, in the first there is no mention of Orome's Path of the Rainbow. An isolated note, obviously written before the present tale, says, when the gods close Valinor, Lórien leaves a path across the mountains called Olore Male, and Manwe the Rainbow, where he walks to survey the world. It is only visible after rain, for then it is wet. 10. Truce. Earlier reading, compromise. It is notable how Manwe is portrayed as primus inter pares, rather than as ruler over the other Valar. 11. On the trees of Kor, see The Coming of the Elves, side 5. 12. See The Tale of the Sun and Moon, side 7. 13. Sari is here and subsequently the name as written, not an emendation from Calavene, the name in the draft texts of the Sun and Moon and the Hiding of Valinor. See side 7. The reading of the draft in this place is the Sun Ship, itself an alteration from the ships, for my father first wrote that neither ship could safely be drawn beneath the earth. 14. The Sleeper in the Tower of Pearl is named in the Cottage of Lost Play, side 1. The Song of the Sleeper is virtually certainly the poem The Happy Mariners, originally written in 1915 and published in 1923. See Humphrey Carpenter, Biography, Appendix C, page 269. This will be given in two versions in connection with the materials for the tale of Earendel in the second part of the Lost Tales. The poem contains a reference to the boats that pass the Tower of Pearl, piled with hoarded sparks of Orient fire that divers won in waters of the unknown sun. 15. The original draft has here, but that is the tale of Corinomi, and I dare not tell it here, for friend Ilios is watching me. See The Tale of the Sun and Moon, side 7, notes 19 and 20. 16. The draft text had here at first, and the galleon of the sun goes out into the dark, and coming behind the world, finds the east again. But there is no door, and the wall of things is lower. And filled with the lightness of the morning, Calavene rides above it, and dawn is split upon the eastern hills, and falls upon the eyes of men. Part of this, from But there is no door, was bracketed, and the passage about the great arch in the east and the gates of morn introduced. In the following sentence, the draft had back over the eastern wall changed to the reading of the second text, back unto the eastern wall, for the name Calavene see the tale of the sun and moon, side 7. 17. That is, until the sunship issues forth through the door of night into the outer dark. As the sunship leaves, the shooting stars pass back into the sky. 18. The second version of this part of Vire's tale, The Haven of the Sun, follows the original draft as emended fairly closely, with no differences of any substance. But the part of her tale that now follows, the weaving of the days and months and years, is wholly absent from the draft text. 19. This concluding passage differs in several points from the original version. In that, Ilios appears again for Gilfanon. The great foreboding was spoken among the gods when they designed first to build the Door of Night, and when Ilinsor has followed Orwendi through the gates, Melko will destroy the gates and raise the eastern wall beyond the skies, and Orwendi and Ilinsor shall be lost. Changes made to names in the Hiding of Valinor. Van Samirin, capital V-A-N-S-A-M-I-R-I-N, changed from Samirien's Road, capital S-A-M-I-R-I-E-N. Samirien occurs as the name of the Feast of Double Mirth, the Theft of Melko, side 5. Kor, capital K-O-R, changed from Kortirion, capital K-O-R-T-I-R-I-O-N. Afterwards, though Kor was not struck out, my father wrote above it Tun, capital T-U-N, with a query, and the same at the occurrence of Kor on page 210. This is the first appearance in the text of the Lost Tales of this name, which ultimately gave rise to Tuna, capital T-U-N-A, the hill on which Tirion was built. Ainairos, capital A-I-N-A-I-R-O-S, changed from Oivarin, capital O-I-V-A-R-I-N. Moritarnon, Tarnfui, capital M-O-R-I-T-A-R-N-O-N, capital T-A-R-N, capital F-U-I. The original draft of the tale has Moritar, capital M-O-R-I-T-A-R, or Tarna Fui, capital T-A-R-N-A, capital F-U-I. Sari, the original draft has Calavene, see The Tale of the Sun and Moon, side 9 and note 13 above. At the first occurrence of the names of the three sons of time, the sequence of forms was Danuin, capital D-A-N-U-I-N, changed from Danos, capital D-A-N-O-S, changed from an illegible form, D-A-N, continued. Ranuin, capital R-A-N-U-I-N, changed from Ranos, capital R-A-N-O-S, changed from Ranoth, capital R-A-N-O-T-H, changed from Ron, capital R-O-N. Fanuin, capital F-A-N-U-I-N, changed from Lathos, capital L-A-T-H-O-S, changed from Lathweg, capital L-A-T-H-W-E-G. Throughout the remainder of the passage, Danuin changed from Dana, capital D-A-N-A, Ranuin changed from Ranoth, Fanuin changed from Lathweg. Aluin, capital A-L-U-I-N, changed from Lumin, capital L-U-M-I-N. Commentary on the Hiding of Valinor. The account of the Council of the Valar and Eldar in the opening of this tale, greatly developed from the preliminary draft given in Note 2, is remarkable and important in the history of my father's ideas concerning the Valar and their motives. In the Silmarillion, page 102, the Hiding of Valinor sprang from the assault of Melkor on the steersman of the moon. But seeing the assault upon Tilion, the Valar were in doubt, fearing what the malice and cunning of Morgoth might yet contrive against them. Being unwilling to make war upon him in Middle-earth, they remembered nonetheless the ruin of Almaren, and they resolved that the like should not befall Valinor. A little earlier in the Silmarillion, page 99, reasons are given for the unwillingness of the Valar to make war. It is said, indeed, that even as the Valar made war upon Melkor for the sake of the Quendi, so now for that time they forbore for the sake of the Hildor, the aftercomers, the younger children of Ilúvatar. For so grievous had been the hurts of Middle-earth in the war upon Utumno, that the Valar feared lest even worse should now befall, whereas the Hildor should be mortal and weaker than the Quendi to withstand fear and tumult. Moreover, it was not revealed to Manwë where the beginning of men should be, north, south, or east. Therefore the Valar sent forth light, but made strong the land of their dwelling. In the Silmarillion there is no vestige of the tumultuous council, no suggestion of a disagreement among the Valar, with Manwë, Varda, and Ulmo actively disapproving the work and holding aloof from it, no mention equally of any pleading for pity on the Noldor by Ulmo, nor of Manwë's disgust. In the old story it was the hostility of some of the Eldar towards the Noldoli, led by an elf of Kopas, Alqualondë, who likewise disappeared utterly. In the later account, there is never a word about the feelings of the elves of Valinor for the exiled Noldor. That was the starting point of the Hiding of Valinor, and it is most curious to observe that the action of the Valar here sprang essentially from indolence mixed with fear. Nowhere does my father's early conception of the Fenian gods appear more clearly. He held, moreover, quite explicitly, that their failure to make war upon Melkor then and there was a deep error, diminishing themselves, and, as it appears, irreparable. In his later writing, the Hiding of Valinor remained indeed, but only as a great fact of mythological antiquity. There is no whisper of its condemnation. The blocking up and utter isolation of Valinor from the world without is perhaps even more strongly emphasized in the early narrative. The cast-off webs of Ungoliant and the use to which the Valar put them disappeared in the later story. Most notable is the different explanation of the fact that the gap in the encircling heights, later named the Kalakiria, was not locked up. In the Silmarillion, page 102, it is said that the pass was not closed because of the Eldar that were faithful, and in the city of Tirion upon the green hill Finarfin yet ruled the remnants of the Noldor in the deep cleft of the mountains. For all those of elven race, even the Vanyar and Ingwe their lord must breathe at times the outer air and the wind that comes over the sea from the lands of their birth, and the Valar would not sunder the Teleri wholly from their kin. The old motive of the Solosimpi, changed to Teleri, wishing this to be done, sufficiently strange, for did the shoreland pipers wish to abandon the shores, disappeared in the general excision of their bitter resentment against the Noldoli, as did Ulmo's refusal to aid them, and Ose's willingness to do so in Ulmo's despite. The passage concerning the magic isles made by Ose is the origin of the conclusion of chapter 11 of the Silmarillion, and in that time which songs call Nurtale Valinoreva, the hiding of Valinor, the enchanted isles were set, and all the seas about them were filled with shadows and bewilderment, and these isles were strung as a net in the shadowy seas from the north to the south before Tolaresia, the lonely isle, is reached by one sailing west. Hardly might any vessel pass between them, for in the dangerous sounds the waves sighed forever upon dark rocks shrouded in mist, and in the twilight a great weariness came upon mariners and a loathing of the sea. But all that ever set foot upon the islands were there entrapped, and slept until the change of the world. It is clear from this passage in the tale that the magic isles were set to the east of the shadowy seas, though the huge glooms stretched forth tongues of darkness towards them, while in an earlier passage, The Coming of the Elves, side 5, it is said that beyond Tol Eressia, which was itself beyond the magic isles, is the misty wall and those great sea glooms beneath which lie the shadowy seas. The later enchanted isles certainly owe much as a conception to the magic isles, but in the passage just cited from the Silmarillion, they were set in the shadowy seas and were in twilight. It is possible, therefore, that the enchanted isles derive also from the twilight isles, The Coming of the Valar, side 3, The Coming of the Elves, side 5. The account of the works of Tulkas and Aule in the northern regions does not read as perfectly in accord with what has been said previously, though a real contradiction is unlikely. In The Flight of the Noldoli, side 6, it is plainly stated that there was a strip of water, Kerkaringa, the chill gulf, between the tip of the ice fang, Helcaraxe, and the great lands, at the time of the crossing of the Noldoli. In this same passage, the ice fang is referred to as a narrow neck, which the gods after destroyed. The Noldoli were able to cross over to the great lands, despite that gap at the far end, The Flight of the Noldoli, side 6, because in the great cold, the sound had become filled with unmoving ice. The meaning of the present passage may be, however, that by the destruction of the ice fang, a much wider gap was made, so that there was now no possibility of any crossing by that route. Of the three roads made by Lorien, Orome, and Mandos, there is no vestige in my father's later writing. The rainbow is never mentioned, nor is there ever any hint of an explanation of how men and elves passed to the halls of Mandos. But it is difficult to interpret this conception of the roads to know to what extent there was a purely figurative content in the idea. For the road of Lorien, or Lore Male, the path of dreams, which is described by Vaire in The Cottage of Lost Play, see sides 1 and 2, there Vaire told that Olore Male came from the lands of men, that it was a lane of deep banks and great overhanging hedges, beyond which stood many tall trees, wherein a perpetual whisper seemed to live, and that from this lane a high gate led to the cottage of the children, or of the play of sleep. This was not far from Kor, and to it came the children of the fathers of men. The Eldar guided them into the cottage and its garden, if they could, lest they strayed into Kor and became enamoured of the glory of Valinor. The accounts in the two tales seem to be in general agreement, though it is difficult to understand the words in the present passage. It ran past the cottage of the children of the earth, and thence down the lane of whispering elms, until it reached the sea. It is very notable that still at this stage in the development of the mythology, when so much more had been written since the coming of Eriol to Tol Eressia, the conception of the children of men coming in sleep by a mysterious road to a cottage in Valinor had by no means fallen away. In the account of Orome's making of the rainbow bridge, the noose that he cast caught on the summit of the great mountain Calorme, Sunrising Hill, in the remotest east. This mountain is seen on the world ship drawing, The Coming of the Valar, side 3. The story that Vaire named the Haven of the Sun provides the fullest picture of the structure of the world that is to be found in the earliest phase of the mythology. The Valar, to be sure, seem strangely ignorant on this subject. The nature of the world that came into being so largely from their own devising, if they needed Ulmo to acquaint them with such fundamental truths. A possible explanation of this ignorance may be found in the radical difference in the treatment of the creation of the world between the early and later forms of the music of the Ainur. I have remarked earlier, side 3, that originally the Ainur's first sight of the world was already in its actuality, and Ilúvatar said to them, "Even now the world unfolds and its history begins," whereas in the developed form it was a vision that was taken away from them and only given existence in the word of Ilúvatar, "Ea, let these things be." It is said in the Silmarillion, page 20, that when the Valar entered into Ea, they were at first a standard and at a loss, for it was as if naught was yet made which they had seen in vision, and all was but on point to begin, and yet unshaped. And there follows, pages 21-2, an account of the vast labours of the Valar in the actual construction of the world. They built lands, and Melkor destroyed them. Valleys they delved, and Melkor raised them up. Mountains they carved, and Melkor threw them down. Seas they hollowed, and Melkor spilled them. In the old version there is none of this, and one gains the impression, though nothing is explicit, that the Valar came into a world that was already made and unknown to them. The gods stalked north and south and could see little. Indeed, in the deepest of these regions they found great cold and solitude, the coming of the Valar, side 3. Although the conception of the world was indeed derived in large measure from their own playing in the music, its reality came from the creative act of Ilúvatar. "We would have the guarding of those fair things of our dreams, which of thy might have now attained to reality," the music of the Ainur, side 2. And the knowledge possessed by the Valar of the actual properties and dimensions of their habitation was correspondingly smaller, so we may perhaps assume, than it was afterwards conceived to be. But this is to lean rather heavily on the matter. More probably the ignorance of the Valar is to be attributed to their curious collective isolation and indifference to the world beyond their mountains that is so much emphasized in this tale. However this may be, Ulmo at this time informed the Valar that the whole world is an ocean, Vai, on which the earth floats, upheld by the word of Ilúvatar, and all the seas of the earth, even that which divides Valinor from the great lands, are hollows in the earth's surface, and are thus distinct from Vai, which is of another nature. All this we have already seen, the coming of the Valar, side 3, and in an earlier tale something has been said, the coming of the Valar, side 3, of the nature of the upholding waters. "Beyond Valinor I have never seen or heard, save that of a surety there are the dark waters of the outer seas that have no tides, and they are very cool and thin, that no boat can sail upon their bosom, or fish swim within their depth, save the enchanted fish of Ulmo and his magic car." So here Ulmo says that neither fish nor boat will swim in its waters, to whom I have not spoken the great word that Ilúvatar said to me, and bound them with the spell. At the outer edge of Vai stands the wall of things, which is described as deep blue. Valinor is nearer to the wall of things than is the eastern shore of the great lands, which must mean that Vai is narrower in the west than in the east. In the wall of things, the gods at this time made two entrances. In the west, the door of night, and in the east, the gates of morn, and what lies beyond these entrances in the wall is called the starless vast and the outer dark. It is not made clear how the outer air, the dark and tenuous realm of Vaitya, that is outside all, the tale of the sun and moon, side 7, is to be related to the conception of the wall of things, or the outer dark. In the rejected preliminary text of this tale, my father wrote at first, see note 16 above, that in the east the wall of things is lower, so that when the sun returns from the outer dark, it does not enter the eastern sky by a door, but rides above the wall. This was then changed, and the idea of the door in the eastern wall, the gates of morn, introduced. But the implication seems clear that the walls were originally conceived like the walls of terrestrial cities or gardens, walls with a top, a ring fence. In the cosmological essay of the 1930s, the Ambarkanta, the walls are quite other. About the world are the Iluramba, or walls of the world. They are as ice and glass and steel, being above all imagination of the children of earth, cold, transparent, and hard. They cannot be seen, nor can they be passed, save by the door of night. Within these walls the earth is globed. Above, below, and upon all sides is Vaya, the enfolding ocean. But this is more like the sea below the earth, and more like to air above the earth. See further The Coming of the Valar, side 3. The tale of Korinomi was never in fact told. In the first version of the present tale, see note 15 above, it seems that Vaire would have liked to tell it, but felt the beady eye of the captious Ayas upon her. In the early Kenya word list, Korinomi is defined as the name of the sun, literally, drowned in the sea, the name being a derivative from a root meaning choke, suffocate, drown, with this explanation. The sun, after fleeing from the moon, dived into the sea and wandered in the caverns of the Oaritsi. Oaritsi is not given in the word list, but Oaris equals mermaid. Nothing is said in the Lost Tales of the Moon giving chase to the sun. It was the stars of Varda that Ilinsor, huntsman of the firmament, pursued, and he was jealous of the supremacy of the sun. The Tale of the Sun and Moon, side 7. The conclusion of Vaire's tale, the weaving of days, months, and years, shows, as it seems to me, my father exploring a mode of mythical imagining that was for him a dead end. In its formal and explicit symbolism, it stands quite apart from the general direction of his thought, and he excised it without trace. It raises also a strange question. In what possible sense were the Valar outside time, before the weavings of Danwin, Ranwin, and Fanwin? In the music of the Ainur, side 2, Ilúvatar said, "Even now the world unfolds, and its history begins." In the final version, the Silmarillion, page 20, it is said that the great music had been but the growth and flowering of thought in the timeless halls, and the vision only a foreshowing. But now they had entered in at the beginning of time. It is also said in the Silmarillion, page 39, that when the two trees of Valinor began to shine, there began the count of time. This refers to the beginning of the measurement of time from the waxing and the waning of the trees. In the present tale, the works of Danwin, Ranwin, and Fanwin are said to be the cause of the subjection of all things within the world to time and change. But the very notion of a history, a consecutive story, self-evidently implies time and change. How then can Valinor be said only now to come under the necessity of change, with the ordering of the motions of the sun and moon, when it has undergone vast changes in the course of the story of the Lost Tales? Moreover, the gods now know that hereafter even they should in counted time be subject to slow eld, and their bright days to waning. But the very statement, for instance, that Omar Amillo was the youngest of the great Valar who entered the world, the coming of the Valar, side 3, is an assertion that the other Valar, older than he, were subject to eld. Age has, of course, for mortal beings two aspects, which draw always closer. Time passes, and the body decays. But of the natural immortality of the Eldar, it is said, the music of the Ainur, side 3, "Nor doth Eld subdue their strength, unless it may be in 10,000 centuries." Thus they age. So Gilfanon is the most aged that now dwelt in the isle, and is one of the oldest of the fairies. The Tale of the Sun and Moon, side 6, but they do not age, do not become enfeebled. Why then do the gods know that hereafter they will be subject to slow eld, which can only mean aging in the latter sense? It may well be that there is a deeper thought here than I can fathom, but certainly I cannot explain it. Finally, at the end of all the early writing concerning it, it may be remarked how major a place was taken in my father's original conception by the creation of the sun and the moon and the government of their motions. The astronomical myth is central to the whole. Afterwards, it was steadily diminished until in the end, perhaps, it would have disappeared altogether. 10. Gilfannon's Tale, The Travail of the Nolloli and the Coming of Mankind. Introduction. The rejected draft text of The Hiding of Valinor continues a little way beyond the end of Vaire's tale thus. Now, after the telling of this tale, no more was there of speaking for that night, but Lindo begged Ilios to consent to a tale-telling of ceremony, to be held the next night or as soon as might be. But Ilios would not agree, pleading matters that he must needs journey to a distant village to settle. So was it that the tale-telling was fixed ere the candles of sleep were lit for a seven night from that time, and that was the day of Turuhalme, (1), or the log-drawing. "'Twill be a fitting day," saith Lindo, "for the sports of the morning and the snow, and the gathering of the logs from the woods, and the songs and drinking of Turuhalme, will leave us of right mood to listen to old tales beside this fire." As I have noticed earlier, the Tale of the Sun and Moon, side 8, the original form of the Tale of the Sun and Moon, and the Hiding of Valinor, belonged to the phase before the entry of Gilfannon of Tavrobel, replacing Ilios. Immediately following this rejected draft text, on the same manuscript page, the text in ink of the Tale of Turambar, Turin, begins with these words. "When then Ilios had spoken his fill, the time for the lighting of candles was at hand, and so came the first day of Turuhalme to an end. But on the second night Ilios was not there, and being asked by Lindo, one Eltas began a tale." What was Ilios's tale to have been? For I think it's certain that it was never written. The answer becomes clear from a separate short text, very rough, which continues on from the discussion at the end of the Hiding of Valinor, given above. This tells that at length the day of Turuhalme was come, and the company from Marvanwachyalyeva went into the snowy woods to bring back firewood on sleighs. Never was the tale fire allowed to go out or to die into grey ash, but on the eve of Turuhalme it sank always to a smaller blaze until Turuhalme itself, when great logs were brought into the room of the tale fire, and being blessed by Lindo with ancient magic, roared and flared anew upon the hearth. Vaire blessed the door and lintel of the hall, and gave the key to Rumil, making him once again the door ward, and to Little Heart was given the hammer of his gong. Then Lindo said, as he said each year, "Lift up your voices, O pipers of the shore, and ye elves of Kor, sing aloud, and all ye Nolloli and hidden fairies of the world, dance ye and sing, sing and dance, O little children of men, that the house of memory resound with your voices." Then was sung a song of ancient days that the Eldar made when they dwelt beneath the wing of Manwë and sang on the great road from Kor to the city of the gods. See The Theft of Melko, side 5. It was now 6 months since Eriol went to visit Meril y Turinki, beseeching a draught of Limpe, see The Chaining of Melko, side 4, and that desire had for a time fallen from him, but on this night he said to Lindo, "Would I might drink with thee?" To this Lindo replied that Eriol should not think to overpass the bounds that Ilúvatar hath set, but also that he should consider that not yet hath Meril denied thee thy desire for ever. Then Eriol was sad, for he guessed in his deepest heart that the savour of Limpe and the blessedness of the elves might not be his for ever. The text ends with Ilios preparing to tell a tale. "I tell but as I may those things I have seen and known of very ancient days within the world when the sun rose first. And there was travail and much sorrow, for Melko reigned unhampered, and the power and strength that went forth from Angamandi reached almost to the ends of the great earth." It is clear that no more was written. If it had been completed, it would have led into the opening of Turamba, cited above, when then Ilios had spoken his fill, and it would have been central to the history of the great lands, telling of the coming of the Nolloli from Valinor, the awakening of men, and the battle of unnumbered tears. The text, just described, linking the hiding of Valinor to Ilios's unwritten tale, was not struck out, and my father later wrote on it, to come after the tale of Earendel and before Ariol fares to Tavrobel, after Tavrobel he drinks of Limpe. This is puzzling, since he cannot have intended the story of the coming of men to follow that of Earendel, but it may be that he intended only to use the substance of this short text, describing the Turuhalme ceremonies, without its ending. However this may be, he devised a new framework for the telling of these tales, though he did not carry it through, and the revised account of the arranging of the next tale-telling has appeared in the Tale of the Sun and Moon, where after Gilfanan's interruption, side 7, it was agreed that 3 nights after that on which the sun and moon and the hiding of Valinor were told by Lindo and Vire, there should be a more ceremonial occasion on which Gilfanan should relate the travail of the Noldoli and the coming of mankind. Gilfanan's tale follows on, with consecutive page numbers, from the second version of Vire's tale of the hiding of Valinor, but Gilfanan here tells it on the night following, not 3 days later. Unhappily, Gilfanan was scarcely better served than Ilioth had been, for if Ilioth scarcely got started, Gilfanan stops abruptly after a very few pages. What there is of his tale is very hastily written in pencil, and it is quite clear that it ends where it does, because my father wrote no more of it. It was here that my father abandoned the lost tale, or more accurately, abandoned those that still waited to be written, and the effects of this withdrawal never ceased to be felt throughout the history of the Silmarillion. The major stories to follow Gilfanan's, those of Beren and Dinuviel, Turin Turamba, the Fall of Gondolin, and the Necklace of the Dwarves, had been written and, in the first 3 cases, rewritten, and the last of these was to lead on to the great tale of Earendel, but that was not even begun. Thus, the lost tales lack their middle and their end. I give here the text of Gilfanan's tale, so far as it goes. Gilfanan's tale, the travail of the Noldoli, and the coming of mankind. Now when Vare made an end, said Gilfanan, complain not if on the morrow I weave a long tale, for the things I tell of cover many years of time, and I have waited long to tell them. And Lindo laughed, saying he might tell to his heart's desire all that he knew. But on the morrow, Gilfanan sat in the chair, and in this wise he began. Now many of the most ancient things of the earth are forgotten, for they were lost in the darkness that was before the sun, and no law may recover them. Yet mayhap this is new to the ears of many here, that when the Teleri, the Noldoli, and the Sulisimpi fared after Orome, and afterward found Valinor, yet was that not all of the race of the Eldalie that marched from Palisor, and those who remained behind are they who many call the Kendi, the lost fairies of the world, but ye elves of Kor name Ilkorin, the elves that never saw the light of Kor. Of these some fell out upon the way, or were lost in the trackless glooms of those days, being wildered and but newly awakened on the earth, but the most were those who left not Palisor at all, and a long time they dwelt in the pine woods of Palisor, or sat in silence, gazing at the mirrored stars in the pale, still waters of awakening. Such great ages fared over them, that the coming of Nornore among them faded to a distant legend, and they said one to another that their brethren had gone westward to the Shining Isles. There, said they, do the gods dwell? And they called them the Great Folk of the West, and thought they dwelt on firelit islands in the